everybody, before Dr. McCarthy starts the farewell tour today, we have an exam on Monday. This is Monday. It's going to be sometime this week on campus. Will be, like it was last time, an exam. Questions from myself, Robin, and Dr. McCarthy. We have for 48 hours. And so let's look at the questions about that.
When is it going to be due? Tuesday?
Probably see what it was last time.
Tuesday?
Yeah, like it was last
right.
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
So, yeah. Probably same deal with last time. And I, Robin and I graded your article reviews, but I never graded things in Canvas that just left me in Canvas before. So I think you should have access to see the grades on Canvas and your, I think it worked. So this worked. They're there. And I failed yours.
Any questions?
All right. Everybody looks like they're here today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who are important to be on Monday missed, I think I can say, a pretty phenomenal.
I spread the word.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of my best.
Weird.
So, do you guys have any questions about Monday?
Yes, can you read it? You usually got everything.
No.
Okay, I thought
I'd try. But I'll just quickly sort of summarize some of the major points, at least as I see them. Again, sort of a overarching theme for my lectures has been in hypertrophy, you're having what we typically will say is a net increase in protein synthesis, right? So it's always a relationship between protein synthesis, protein degradation. As long as you have a net increase, meaning that the rate of protein synthesis is greater than the rate of degradation, there's a couple different ways that you could do that, right? You could increase protein synthesis and degradation remains the same, the turnover. Or alternatively, you could just keep the rate of protein synthesis the same and lower degradation, right? And so the end result would be there would be a net increase in protein synthesis. What I've tried to emphasize is that in general, the field thinks that there are changes in protein degradation in response to a hypertrophic stimulus are minimal. And really what's occurring is you're enhancing or increasing protein synthesis. And then the idea is that over time, say in response to a bout of resistance exercise, you increase protein synthesis, and over time, with training, you have an accumulation of protein, and that protein would be, in general, myofiber. Okay. And I also talk just in general that hypertrophy is just cell growth, right? And the way in which cells grow, in general, is a highly conserved mechanism. And I tried to contrast between translational efficiency as opposed to capacity, right? So efficiency is how effective you are able to, how the rate at which particular, you can think of it as particular one ribosome is able to translate an mRNA, right, per unit of time. And so we talked about M4 signaling and its impact on 4-ABP as well as P70S6 kinase, which in turn phosphorylates, it's a kinase, so it phosphorylates another protein called RPS6, which is a ribosomal protein associated with a small subunit. And so you can have changes in efficiency, and these are not mutually exclusive. You can also have increases in capacity. So the example there is how many ribosomes do you have per muscle cell? Okay, and I used the analogy of like a factory. Right? So you have more ribosomes, more factories, you can produce more protein. And that led into, we talked about ribosomes and ribosome biogenesis and the transcription of ribosomal DNA, and we talked about that there's many copies of ribosomal DNA. And sorry, then we talked about the notion or the idea that, in fact, remarkably, ribosomes are made up of RNA, and they have catalytic activity, unlike, or in a unique way, when we think of enzymes, right, proteins that have catalytic activity, those are proteins. And I was trying to say how I think amazing it is that, in fact, the ribosome is made up of RNA, though it does have roughly 80 proteins associated with it. Those proteins enhance its activity, but are not absolutely necessary for the ability of the ribosome to make peptide bonds and form synthesized new proteins. And then we talked a lot about how, in terms of highlighting the importance or the potential role that increased translational capacity, right, which is going to be driven by ribosome biogenesis and its relationship to hypertrophy. So I talked about how a recent paper came out where they were able to use the synergistic ablation model to modulate the degree of hypertrophy, and they saw this really nice correlation between the degree of hypertrophy and how much the degree of ribosomes, how many ribosomes are there. Okay? But what's the problem with correlations? The correlations, right? So there's, right, you guys learned the mantra, correlation is not causation. So these are hypertrophy, or the degree of hypertrophy and the amount of ribosome biogenesis going on, or they think that a bar was like almost 0.98 or something. So really high correlation. So really what you would need to do is some type of loss or gain experiment, right? So something where you could could you drive ribosome biogenesis? Would that be sufficient to increase hypertrophy and muscle mass? Or alternatively, loss of function, right? So talk briefly about, we looked at just kind of the core enhancer on the ribosomal DNA gene. We talked about a transcription factor called UBF. So what if I knocked out UBF and completely blocked the ability of the cell, the muscle cell, to make new ribosomes, and then I subjected them to, say, synergistic ablation? Would they still be able to hypertrophy? So when you want to move beyond just a correlation, you always want to think about loss and gain of function type of experiments. Those would probably be a good exam question. Now that I have to come up with something. Okay, and then at the very end, I had a little summary slide where I said, I don't want to set up this dichotomy that it's either efficiency or capacity that is driving hypertrophy, but sort of a synthesis of the data throughout the field is that early on, you have enhanced translational efficiency, and that appears to be important for, say, early hypertrophic response, but then to sustain that increase in protein synthesis is going to probably or may require, again, somebody has to go and do those experiments, increases in translational capacity driven by ribosome biogenesis. Okay, so here would be a good thing to think about. So I showed some nice figures where in response to a hypertrophic stimulus, you see an increase in the amount of total RNA, right? And total RNA serves as a proxy for ribosomes, because total RNA, when you isolate total RNA from a cell, any cell, is typically 80-85% of that RNA that you isolate is going to be ribosomal RNA. So in response to a hypertrophic stimulus, we see this really robust increase in total RNA, and we interpret that as being driven by increased ribosome biogenesis as a result of increased ribosomal DNA transcription. Right? So what could also lead to an increase in total RNA or ribosomal RNA. Cool. That would be a good question. So I'll give you a hint. Think about in the same way, whenever you do measurements and you take a single time point, right, you're looking at really a steady state value. So example, a lot of times we'll look at gene expression, right? And we'll measure the amount of a particular mRNA after 3 days of synergistic ablation. We say, oh, look at gene X is up by this much. And we would like to interpret that as that reflects an increase in the transcription of that gene, right? Or if we're talking about ribosomal RNA, we think of that as enhanced transcription of ribosomal DNA. But what's the other half of that equation? No. You got the turnover, right? So again, in the same way I talked about protein synthesis, protein degradation, right? We're always saying, oh, increases in muscle mass are primarily being driven by increased protein synthesis, and degradation remains the same. The turnover remains the same. Alternatively, though, if you could keep protein synthesis the same and lower degradation, then you're going to have an accumulation of protein. In the same way, when you look at changes in gene expression on a single time point, right, a gene goes up, you want to say, oh, that gene, the expression of that gene went up because I enhanced transcription. I turned on that gene. Alternatively, the gene could be transcribed at the same rate, but maybe the stability of the mRNA that I'm measuring changes, becomes less. So it turns over slower. So as a result, you get an accumulation. So the other end of, and some people have begun to look at this, and it's kind of a new area in our field, we're always thinking of increases in ribosomal RNA or total RNA, number of ribosomes, being driven by enhanced transcription of ribosomal DNA. But could it be that the increase that we see is because maybe the turnover of ribosomes has changed, so they become more stable?
What's this little
Oh, what is?
Yeah, what might be.
So there are some, what are they called? Like, I want to say they're referred to as like, there's a handful of them, like XO, I think it's EXOSC1 has been shown to degrade ribosomes. So actually, a guy down at Auburn has begun to look at, is there a change in the expression of these proteins that have thought to have a role in the turnover of ribosomes. So that's something that in our lab we haven't really begun to look at. But again, that's a possibility that maybe what's really happening, and I could talk to you guys about it afterwards, but the data that we have suggests that when we look at ribosomal DNA transcription, where we see a lot of activity is very early on in the hypertrophic response, and it is precedes the increase in total RNA. So it looks like you're really getting a lot of ribosomal DNA transcription early on, but then we can't detect changes until 2 or 3, 5 days later. So could it be that the stability of the ribosome is actually changing in response to a hypertrophic stimulus?
So it's becoming more stable or less stable?
More stable. Right? So if you think about it, you'd say, okay, actually a paper came out last year and said a ribosome has a half-life of about 10 days, which I found remarkable. That seems like a long time to me. So now that means every 10 days, you know, you would say, let's just say simplistically, half of the ribosomes turn over or degraded, right? But now what if all of a sudden somehow something changes and the stability of those ribosomes increases? So now instead of turning over every 10 days, now they turn over every 20 days. So they're more stable.
Right, when you said less of the proteins that was created are just lower, or is that there's actually something to do with the stability?
I'm purely speculating. It could be that I don't know the details of. I don't know if we really have a detailed understanding of how the ribosome is targeted for degradation. So it could be that the proteins involved in the turnover, they're downregulated in response to hypertrophic stimulus. I would say based on our microarray data, we don't really see that. Alternatively, you know, the way in which the ribosome may be modified, you know, sort of ubiquitination, which targets proteins for degradation, could be that the ribosome itself is also targeted for turnover by some process, some, again, say post-transcriptional modification. Yeah?
Sorry, I'm just a little confused. So if you're seeing an increase in the ribosomal RNA, right?
Yep.
But then the turnover is less because they're more stable. How is there an increase? I'm not sure. So I'm thinking, like, if they turn over less, they're lasting longer, they're more stable, then how are you seeing an increase in the ribosome?
So you know that the ribosome is made up of ribosomal RNA, right? So what I'm saying is that so if the ribosome has this, like, for example, I said, paper came out and said it's 10 days.
Yeah.
So now, in response to a hypertrophic stimulus, it goes to 20 days. So that means there's always a certain rate at which ribosomes are turning over, they're degrading, but that in a resting muscle is matched perfectly by the synthesis of new ribosomes. So now all of a sudden that's why you just have some constant level or some homeostatic level of ribosomes. Now if I don't change anything except the stability and I'm still transcribing ribosomal DNA at the same level, but they're turning over slower, you're going to accumulate more. I'm just saying that in our example, it's an accelerate, you know, we're looking at a really short window, but that could be. So my whole point there was I just wanted to try to get you guys to think, you know, I focused a lot on ribosomal DNA transcription, which is ribosome biogenesis, as driving the change or promoting enhanced translation capacity. But there's a flip to that whole part of the equation that I didn't even talk about. And then part of that is because there's just not a lot at this point in our field known about that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, the decrease in the rate of turnover, you could influence mitochondrial efficiency. Right? The proteins turn over for a reason. And, like, with some of the anti-catabolic growth in muscle, slowing down those herbs, attenuating those catabolic processes actually leads to negative muscle damage.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, like, you mean like autophagy? Is that what you're talking about?
Or just like not myostatin, but drugs like not myostatin that block the catabolic processes in the muscle and slow down protein degradation. You're accumulating like byproducts and will it or you like the same kind of
I'm
right, you get bigger where you're just asking for
the Yeah, and we'll actually talk about that, which leads nicely into what we're going to talk about today. We finished up just quickly. So I would be remiss if I did not talk about myostatin. I'm not going to go into a lot of the mechanistic details by how myostatin works. I'll touch on it just briefly, but I think Esther is probably going to talk more about myostatin in detail. Right? So the name myostatin kind of gives away what it does. Myo, muscle, statin, kind of puts a brake. So myostatin is a negative regulator of skeletal muscle mass. So in the absence of that brake, right, what happens if you take your foot off of your you know, you got the accelerator and you got the brake and they're kind of, and all of a sudden you take off the brake, you go. So in the same way, these guys discovered this protein, myostatin, and when they knocked it out, you got a lot of significant increase in muscle mass, okay? So then just for people who weren't here, and just for review, so here is a wild-type mouse. Here's a myostatin knockout. You can see already it has a lot more muscle. After they identified myostatin, these guys are Belgian blue or double-muscled cattle. And these were just created through breeding. They actually went and sequenced their DNA and found out, in fact, they have a mutation in the myostatin gene. Right, and I'm not sure about these are whippets. I'm not sure. I assume this was through breeding again. This is kind of crazy. So just to give you a little bit of background, so myostatin is actually part of this TGF-beta family of proteins, and as you can see, it's a huge family. So it's also known as GDF8, growth differentiation factor. Where is it? Is it at the bottom? There it is. Somebody has good vision. Is it here? Anyway, so here's GDF8. But you can see there's a whole family. GDF11 has made a lot of news lately. There's a lot of controversy about it, but in any case, so myostatin is GDF8. But what I want to do is, probably on the exam, I'll ask you guys to go into great detail about this whole family. Is that funny? No. I just put it up here again, a lot of times when I teach, I don't expect you to remember the details, but I just want you to have a sense of sort of the complete picture so that you don't walk out into the world and think that GDF8 or myostatin is like just one of two, but it's a big, huge family of proteins, okay? Here is from the original paper in 1999, and the amazing thing is that this GDF8 is only, or highly, I would say only, but we always like to temper our interpretation and say highly enriched in skeletal muscle, okay? And in response, when they knocked out myostatin and they looked at the size of the muscle fibers, what they're showing you here is a percent of fibers with a particular cell diameter. The shaded is wild type. The empty bars are the knockout. And what you can see is that you get a significant shift, right, in the curve, suggesting or indicating that there's an increase in the size of the muscles. So here is about all I'm going to give you in terms of, because I don't want to get too redundant, but so myostatin is actually referred to as a myokine. You guys heard of myokines, right? So these are proteins that are secreted by the muscle. They get into circulation, and they can have effects on distal tissues or other muscle. All right, so myostatin is referred to as a myokine. These are some other members. Binds a receptor, activates this SMAD2-3, and what this is really doing is it kind of has two effects. Primarily, it can... Remember we talked about AKT, and AKT, in addition to activating mTOR and increasing protein synthesis, AKT also can phosphorylate this transcription factor called FOXO. And when you block, if you prevent phosphorylation of FOXO, right, then what it can do is it can translocate into the nucleus and drive expression of these genes, which are referred to as atrogenes, so they're ubiquitin ligases. They target muscle proteins for degradation. So you can see how this pathway will promote muscle atrophy. So again, if you get rid of this, then that signaling pathway is disrupted. so you're not going to promote muscle atrophy or degradation. So here is a paper where they actually was a little bit later, but I wanted to kind of give you guys an idea of what it's actually doing to the muscle itself. So here is EDL, soleus. So this is wild type. These are a heterozygous, right? So heterozygous, it has one good copy, one knockout, and then here's the knockout. Muscle weight, so I think this is probably milligrams. Again, you can see that it's roughly 12 milligrams, goes up to over 19, so the muscle significantly bigger. All right. Again, now here is, this is where it gets a little bit, remember how we talked about how can a muscle get bigger? Two ways, hypertrophy, increase in cell size, or hyperplasia, increase in cell number. So what do you see here? Goes from about 1,500 fibers per EDL muscle up over, what's that, about 2,400. Right? So you're increasing the number of fibers in the muscle itself. And here is the cross-sectional area, fiber area, about 1,200, and we go up to a little over 1,500. So that was one of the big things, big revelations with the myostatin knockout, that yes, there was an increase in myofiber size, but that the number of fibers was actually significantly increasing. Okay? So that, again, and so what you need to do is when you think about this, this is in the context of embryonic development. Right, so apparently myostatin has a role in setting fiber number. And so when it's gone, you have an increase in the number of muscle fibers, which is increasing the overall size of the muscle. And you also do have an increase in fiber size, but it's not as dramatic as you would have thought based on, you know, if it was all just hypertrophy. What else? This is just, I think this is for the cross-sectional area of the whole muscle. Again, it just shows you, I mean, significantly bigger, and I think pretty much the same for the soleus. So here are the contractile properties, and this is where Tim can help me, because this is not my area, but what I did want to point out is again, I assume this is like peak tension, PT. as you would, in my simplistic understanding of muscle function, all things being equal, a bigger muscle generates more force, and that's what you see in the knockout. What was the one that I... So this is, I guess, force. Yeah, what was the one that was here? So this is this specific force?
Can we peak stress or specific force? Yeah.
So here was, this was one of the big deals with the myostatin knockout. So my understanding of specific force or specific tension, right, sort of the amount of force generated per area, cross-sectional area, and what you actually see is that it goes from 243 to, say, 200. So that was one of the big revelations, maybe kind of touching on what you guys were just talking about, that you actually have a bigger muscle, but it's functionally not as good. All right? However, that was one of the points. EDL is primarily a fast twitch, type 2 fibers. Soleus, in the mouse, it's 50-50, type 2A, type 1, but it's definitely more oxidative. And in this case, we don't see that difference in specific force. All right. So this, the general consensus is that it the defect in muscle function that you see in the myostatin knockout primarily is affecting type 2 or fast twitch fibers. Yeah.
Isn't there, with the, would you do the myostatin knockout too in the bottom of the knees? There's some kind of fibers that shift to the phase that doesn't occur if you just do like
yes, yes.
It's,
you have, let's see, I was looking at that the other day. I think you have a loss of type 2.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was thinking of the EDL.
Yeah.
Why do you need specific
type? Ah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah.
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 Okay, so here again, this is just sort of a summary of the sort of the signaling pathway, but what I wanted to highlight is, so here is, you know, your myostatin, and I don't know if there's a lot of processing that goes on with myostatin. I'm not going to get into that, but what I wanted to highlight here is that there's another protein called follistatin. Myostatin binds to this activin 2B receptor in part, and this is an antibody fragment or a fragment of the activin 2B receptor, and these can basically act as sponges to suck up all the circulating myostatin. Right? So, I wanted to show you this because you thought the myostatin knockout was impressive. These guys are even bigger. So here is a control mouse. Here is this dominant negative activin 2B receptor. So they basically overexpressed this, okay, a portion of the activin 2B receptor, or they overexpressed follistatin. And they, so they're basically sucking up all the myostatin. And this guy is just enormous. So what the interpretation of this is that, in fact, while myostatin is really important, there are other TGF-beta family members that also appear to have a role in regulating skeletal muscle mass. Okay? So by overexpressing a portion of the receptor or follistatin, now, while you're also sucking up a lot of the myostatin, there are likely other TGF-beta family members that you're also removing, say, from circulation. And the end result is you get some really big, huge increases in muscle mass. Tim's back to
good.
No, it's just like, yeah. And it actually turns out there are, you know, people are doing, like, now that genome sequencing is so inexpensive, a lot of the top bodybuilders that you see, there's one in particular that supposedly this individual has, I think it's a mutation in their activin 2B receptor that, you know, in effect would be like a myostatin knockout. So, I'm interested in muscle hypertrophy. My interest grew out of just an interest in wanting. I always thought if I understood how your muscles hypertrophy at a molecular or cellular level, then the idea would be that I could sort of reverse engineer the most effective training programs. And while I still am somewhat interested in that, the way in which I try to sell my research to the funding agencies is that I say, hey, if I understand how muscles are, the mechanisms by which muscles hypertrophy, then can I use that information to prevent the loss of skeletal muscle mass as you get older, right? We know you have a loss of muscle mass. If you're in bed, prolonged inactivity, from a therapeutic or rehab perspective, right? If I could develop some pharmaceutical that would help you maintain your muscle mass, before and after surgery. That's going to, the notion is that that's going to speed your rehab. In certain systemic diseases, say like cancer, you have cancer cachexia where people have significant loss of skeletal muscle mass. And so again, if we can maintain that muscle mass, that's going to, the thought is, improve the quality of your life, your independence. And then finally, you know, we have plans. We'd like to go to Mars. And we know that being in a zero-G environment, you lose a lot of muscle mass. And NASA actually spends a good deal of time trying to develop these astronauts when they go up into space and they're in the space station. They have to exercise up to 2 hours a day. Right? And from NASA's perspective, I have this highly trained individual. Their time should not be spent exercising. Right? And in addition, if you're exercising, you're burning more calories. That means I got to bring more food. You're breathing more oxygen. So all of these things, it would be wonderful for us to be able to develop some pharmaceutical that maybe mimicked, like you just got done working out. Right? That would be the ultimate goal. So now you can maintain your muscle mass in a zero-G environment. Unfortunately, NASA, they used to fund basic research. Now they really, they want stuff that they can give to astronauts right now. So, but in any case, where I'm going with all of this is this: these results, people said, hey, well, maybe targeting myostatin is going to be an effective therapy to maintain muscle mass under different conditions. And again, which, this is just a follow-up just to show you from the different mice. This was the activin 2B receptor, and this was the follistatin. And you can just see, it's probably a little hard to see, but here's the whole muscle, and you can see that it's just enormous increases in fiber size. Okay, so this was, so all the mice that I've shown you so far, these mice were, the genes were overexpressed or were knocked out throughout development. So if you were interested in saying, hey, well, gosh, maybe manipulating myostatin levels would be potentially the basis for an effective therapy to treat the loss of muscle mass. Well, you'd want to know, well, what if I knock it out or prevent it in the adult? So this is, remember we talked the very first day about the Cre-Lox system, where you have the ability to knock out a gene when you want? So here what they did is they knocked out myostatin in the adult animal. And sure enough, they got a very dramatic effect, increase in muscle size. So that provides the basis to think that maybe targeting myostatin would be a viable strategy to prevent the loss of muscle mass. And so here, this is a little, it's really hard to see, but I just put it up here because these are all the different companies that are desperately trying or have tried to target myostatin through different ways. And basically what they're trying to do is by giving you, typically it's an antibody or a fragment of the activin 2B receptor, they're trying to remove myostatin from circulation. And that has been, as far as I understand, that's been the primary avenue by which these pharmaceutical companies have been trying to target myostatin. And what this just also really highlights is, I like to think, that there really is a genuine interest from a medicinal standpoint in manipulating or being able to manipulate skeletal muscle mass. I don't know if you guys will get into it, but right, I mean, there's been this emerging appreciation over probably the last years or so that besides just being able to provide, you know, force to move around, that skeletal muscle has a big impact on whole body metabolism. So just in addition to maintaining muscle mass, muscle has an important role in metabolism. So I just want to finish with this. Novartis is a really big pharmaceutical company. And you can see, this was just last year. I cannot pronounce the name of their drug. But in any case, you can see they said it plumped. So all of these efforts to target myostatin in humans in clinical trials have not ended well. And in fact, I don't know the details of why the clinical trials, a lot of them were ended prematurely. Obviously, these are adverse reactions. But unfortunately, while all the basic research on myostatin indicates that it would be an effective target, and even the animal research would support that conclusion, and this is always a challenge when you go from doing basic research and you try to translate it into humans, that while we are, in general, highly conserved between, we're all mammals, a lot of times things fail. So, my understanding is, though, the pharmaceutical companies, so we actually know, he's actually been here, David Glass, he came here, he might have actually been in this classroom maybe. He gave a talk, so he is the head of the skeletal muscle program at Novartis. And he presented data, and I don't know that it ever went to, I don't know if it's the same drug, but he presented data where they gave a single injection and showed sustained increases in muscle mass for up to 6 weeks in humans. I don't know if it was the same drug or not, but he came here and talked about it.
It was a different drug.
Was it?
Yeah, so the thing with the FDA is, particularly like with the aging, there's not a real appreciation for muscle function as like an endocrine therapy or so how they're judging the efficacy of a lot of these drugs is mobility, not a gain in muscle mass. So
yeah.
Some of these trials have shown is that over the course of 6 months, older adults have put on like 3 to 5 kilograms of mass, but their gait speed or their ability to walk 400 meters stays the same. So, it takes longer to affect functional changes,
yeah.
And not all the time, just because you increase muscle mass, you increase walking.
Yeah.
Could the discrepancy between some of the animal studies and the human work be in the way they're targeting myostatin? Maybe the animal models are losing the genome. You're manipulating the actual genetic code, whereas in human studies, they're not doing that. They're going to give them an antibody. Have any animal studies tried?
There's the animal studies where they've done these activin 2B receptor fragments or the antibodies against myostatin, and then they show really good efficacy. And then that's the basis for, moving into human studies.
Yeah, and I think too, the version is GDF11 is now thought to have a very similar function to GDF8. And so, is there like a sort of redundancy in the human system not present at mice, where if you suppress GDF8, then GDF11 is compromised?
Yeah, so GDF11, though, right, when it first came out, it was a group from Harvard, which basically showed exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It probably would have been fun to present some of that. They came out with 3 papers back-to-back-to-back in Science, which Science is one of the premier journals in science. And they showed that, in fact, with aging, GDF11 levels went down. And if they restored GDF11, then they had one paper on cognitive function improved. Next one was muscle mass. Next one was, I think, the heart. Well, Novartis came out, and David Glass came out, and was like, can I say bullshit?
Yeah.
Like, no. I mean, because, again, if you remember that the family I showed you of all the TGF-beta, well, GDF-11 and GDF-8, myostatin, are almost identical. They're really similar. So a lot of people were like, how is it that GDF8, myostatin, blocks muscle growth? And these guys were coming out and saying, oh, GDF11 actually is beneficial. So I don't know where, I mean, it was a huge controversy in the field.
Yeah, I think it's pretty well accepted now, like GDF11's function is very similar to GDF8. Yeah. Something that was going on is because their molecular structure is so simple, the assay that was used for like the first 10 years, I guess, of this kind of biopharm research was capturing both.
Yeah.
So what you thought you were quantifying one molecule, you were actually capturing both.
Yeah.
Not until recently, Mayo Clinic developed an immunoplex assay that can differentiate GDF8 and 11. You can also differentiate GDF8 if in its false that it bounds to it or not. Right? It's pretty much latent in the circulation if it is bound.
Yeah.
And before they were kind of capturing that and saying, we have this increased expression.
Okay, so anyway, that's all I have for today. I would say you guys have a test starting Monday.
Well, it's going to start end of this week.
Okay. So I would. So I guess they can ask me questions up until Friday.
Until you get us the questions that you want us to get Friday.
Okay. All right. So I would say over the next couple days. So by Friday, if you have any questions. After that, I can't answer any questions. Right? I think that's it.